Imagine you're standing on the flight line. It's a warm Saturday morning at an air show somewhere in America. Maybe Oshkosh, maybe Reno, maybe a county fairground in the middle of nowhere that somehow managed to book the greatest act in the business. The announcer calls the next performer, and out on the runway taxiing into position is a bright yellow twin-engine business airplane. Not a Mustang, not a Corsair, not a Thunderbird trailing colored smoke in tight formation, just a yellow Rockwell Shrike Commander. The kind of airplane a dentist might fly his family to Florida on a long weekend. The crowd murmurs, "There's some confusion, this is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. And that yellow airplane is about to do something you won't believe." Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now back to that yellow airplane on the runway. The pilot lines up, runs up both engines, and climbs away. So far, so ordinary. And then at altitude, he reaches over and shuts off one engine, then the other. Both engines, off. Propellers windmilling. What happens next is why Neil Armstrong once said that Bob Hoover was the greatest aviator he had ever seen. And when Neil Armstrong says something like that, you sit up straight and you listen. Robert A. Hoover was born in Nashville, Tennessee on April 24, 1922. He was 17 years old when he talked his way into his first airplane ride at the local airport. And by 18, he was trading hangar sweeping and airplane washing for flight time. This is the origin story of half the great pilots in history. And it never gets old. He was different from the start. His instructors noticed it immediately. Not just that he was smooth on the controls, though he was. Not just that he was precise, though he was that too. It was the way he seemed to read an airplane's energy, the way he knew instinctively where the machine was going before it got there. Some pilots fly the airplane they're in. Bob Hoover flew the airplane 2 seconds ahead. The Army Air Forces got hold of him after Pearl Harbor. He trained as a fighter pilot and distinguished himself immediately, so much so that his instructors began pushing him toward test pilot school. But Hoover didn't want a flight test assignment. He wanted to be where the shooting was. He got what he asked for. By early 1944, he was flying Spitfires in the Mediterranean Theater, the Supermarine Spitfire. That extraordinary British fighter with the elliptical wing you could pick out of the sky at 1,000 yards. Americans who flew them fell in love with the way they responded, light and immediate, like the airplane was reading your intentions. Hoover flew Spitfires the way Spitfires were supposed to be flown. On a day in February of 1944 over the south of France, German fighters bounced his flight. His Spitfire took hits. The engine quit. He went into the cold water off the French coast, and German forces pulled him out. He was 21 years old. He was a prisoner of war. The Germans recognized fairly quickly that they had someone exceptional on their hands. They flew him in various captured Allied aircraft during his captivity, apparently fascinated by what he could do. Some accounts describe the German pilots watching him with something close to professional respect, the kind that passes between pilots regardless of what flag they fly under. Hoover, for his part, was watching them right back, studying the guards, the routines, the layout of the camp, and the airfield that sat tantalizingly close to the wire. He spent more than a year at Stalag Luft 1, the German prisoner of war camp near the town of Barth on the Baltic Sea. 14 cold months behind the wire as Germany collapsed from both sides. And then, in the spring of 1945, Bob Hoover made his move. He slipped out of the camp hidden in a work party that went beyond the perimeter. He made his way to the nearby Luftwaffe airfield, and sitting on the ramp in the chaos of a Reich in its final days, unguarded, was a Focke-Wulf 190, a German fighter. One of the finest piston fighters the Luftwaffe ever built, powerful radial engine, heavy and fast and built for war. Think about what Bob Hoover was standing in front of. He had not flown in over a year. He had never flown a Focke-Wulf 190. He had no maps, no charts, no radio contact, no ammunition. He had no idea how much fuel was in the tanks. German guards could come back at any moment. He climbed into the cockpit anyway. He figured out the instrument panel by touch and by logic and by the universal truth that an airplane is an airplane. Throttle, mixture, switches that do what switches do. He started the engine. He taxied to the runway. He took off. He flew that German fighter low and fast, heading west toward Holland, toward Allied lines, toward home. At some point, Allied anti-aircraft fire opened up on him, because from the ground, he was an FW-190, and FW-190s were the enemy. He kept flying. He found a Dutch airfield under Allied control, set up an approach, and rolled out with his hands in the air. He climbed out of a German fighter airplane wearing a grin, more than a year in a German prison camp. out in a stolen Focke Wulf and a prayer that the fuel held. He was not yet 23 years old. After VE Day, Bob Hoover came home and did what great pilots did in 1945. He went to California, to the Mojave Desert, to a long flat lakebed called Muroc Army Airfield, the place that would eventually grow into Edwards Air Force Base. He became a test pilot for North American Aviation, and he found himself in the middle of the most exciting few years in the history of aviation. Muroc, in the late 1940s, was something else entirely. A collection of bleached wooden buildings and canvas tents baking in the desert heat, populated by the best pilots in the world, flying machines that had no manuals yet, because nobody had flown them before. The air smelled like avgas and hydraulic fluid and possibility. Yeager was there, Crossfield was there, test pilots who rewrote the envelope every Tuesday. Hoover fit in like he'd been born there, and then came October 14, 1947. Bob Hoover was flying an F-80 Shooting Star jet as chase aircraft that morning, staying close to a bright orange Bell X-1 rocket plane that had just dropped away from a B-29 at high altitude. The X-1 was pointed at Mach 1, at the sound barrier that some engineers still believed would stop any airplane cold. The pilot was a young captain named Chuck Yeager. Hoover watched from the chase plane the day the sound barrier fell. He was close enough to see it happen, to see the contrail pattern, to watch history being made in the Mojave Air, and then he flew his F-80 back to Muroc, having burned his fuel on the chase, and set up a dead-stick approach to the lakebed. No engine, just energy and judgment and the kind of nerve that sends men to Focke Wulf cockpits in occupied airfields. Greased it in. Just another Tuesday for Bob Hoover. Now here's where it gets interesting. He eventually took all of that instinct and precision and sheer stick and rudder mastery, and put it in front of audiences at air shows. And American aviation has never been quite the same since. His act became the most famous in the business. He flew a bright yellow Rockwell Shrike Commander that he called Ole Yeller, a twin-engine business airplane. He'd take it to altitude, run it out to the show line, and then he would shut off both engines, both of them cold, and then he would fly an aerobatic routine. Loops, rolls, a Cuban 8, a Chandelle, all of it in a dead airplane, with two-stop propellers, and nothing between him and the runway, but the energy he had stored in altitude and airspeed. No power to bail out a mistake, no option to go around, no throttle to advance, one shot at the landing every single time. He never missed. Pilots who had been flying for decades would stand on the flight line and watch and go quiet, not applauding, just watching. With the kind of expression you see on someone who is seeing something that shouldn't be possible but is happening right in front of them anyway. This wasn't showmanship. This wasn't crowd-pleasing tricks. This was a human being operating an airplane at the absolute outermost limit of what an airplane can do. With nothing between him and the ground but 40 years of instinct and a gift that you either have or you don't. He also flew a North American P-51 Mustang in the shows, and he had a bit where he'd pour lemonade from a pitcher into a glass while the airplane was in a slow roll without spilling a drop. It sounds like a parlor trick until you understand what it demonstrates. When an airplane is in perfect coordination, in a perfect roll with perfect ball, there are no lateral forces on anything in the cockpit. Gravity doesn't care which way is up. The lemonade stays in the glass because physics is physics. If there's any slipping or skidding, any imperfection in the coordination, the lemonade goes sideways. Hoover's lemonade never went sideways. Jimmy Doolittle called Bob Hoover the greatest pilot he had ever seen. Chuck Yeager said essentially the same thing. Neil Armstrong, who flew the X-15 and commanded Apollo 11 and walked on the moon, said Hoover was the greatest aviator he had ever seen. These are not men who distributed compliments casually. These are men who understood exactly what excellence looked like and called it by its right name when they found it. And then in 1992, the Federal Aviation Administration revoked his medical certificate. Hoover was 70 years old, and FAA medical examiner determined that he showed signs of neurological decline, signs of cognitive impairment. Without a valid medical, he could not fly. The airshow career that had spanned decades was done, except Bob Hoover was not done. What followed was 3 years of one of the most contentious bureaucratic fights in the history of American aviation. Hoover and his legal team argued that the FAA's examiners had made errors, that their conclusions were not supported by independent neurological testing, that a battery of specialists examining the same man reached completely different conclusions. And the aviation community came out for him in a way that was remarkable to watch. Neil Armstrong wrote letters to the FAA on Hoover's behalf. Chuck Yeager testified. Test pilots and airshow pilots and airline captains went on record to say that this man's hands had not lost a thing, that they had watched him fly, and that whatever the paperwork said, the airplane said something different. In 1995, after 3 years of fighting, the FAA restored Bob Hoover's medical certificate. He went back to the air shows. At age 73, he flew Ole Yeller with both engines off and he landed it perfect, and he walked away from the airplane like he'd done it 1,000 times, because he had. He made his final air show appearance in 1999. At age 77, he walked away from it on his own terms. Nobody pushed him out. Nobody told him it was time. He decided and he left. Bob Hoover died on October 25, 2016, in Los Angeles, California. He was 94 years old. In a lifetime at the controls, he had flown more than 300 different types of aircraft. He never bent an airplane in an airshow performance, not once. He stole a German fighter from an occupied airfield and flew home in it. He flew Chase on the day the sound barrier fell, and then dead-sticked a jet back to the lake bed on the same afternoon. He flew loops in a dead business airplane and landed it perfectly, into his mid-70s, because that was what he did. The next time you hear someone called the greatest stick and rudder man who ever lived, you know the name they're measuring against. Most of what I shared today comes from Hoover's own memoir, Forever Flying, along with decades of coverage in Flying Magazine and AOP Pilot, and the EAA's Airshow Archives, all of it worth reading more at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger Blue Skies.